Our speakers tonight, as you know from the posters, are Chris Hedges and Marshall O'Nellian. The second speaker is Marshall O'Nellian, who is professor of physics at the UW here, born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He was an Eagle Scout at 13, a U.S. Air Force officer, and has been at the UW since 1987. Marshall lives in Stoughton and is the author, along with another speaker in our series, whom you will meet in the coming weeks, of Seeking Truth, Living with Doubt. Please welcome our speakers and enjoy the evening.
Well, let me start by assuring you that I won't take 50 minutes. And I'm not taking anything away from Mr. Hedges, because I happen to agree with what he said, in spite of the fact that he's a liberal. When I was introduced, you noticed Dr. Leonard said that I was an Air Force officer, and I had a reason for including that other than an attempt to make you feel sorry for me.
Will you try to stand a little closer to the mic?
Okay. Okay. About 3.5 years ago, I was reading articles about the Air Force officers at the Air Force Academy who were engaged in proselytizing, Christian proselytizing, with the cadets. Now, where I come from, that's called a power differential. And at least in the case of university professors, I can't put my students in jail. But if I'm an Air Force officer at the academy, I can. And I got irritated. And coming from the South, of course, I expressed my irritation. I wrote a letter to the brand new superintendent of the academy basically saying, you are a worthless pissant, a disgrace to the uniform, and you ought to resign. And I got a reply. And the reply said, give me a break. I just started. I've only been here 6 weeks. Give me a chance to fix this problem. Now 3 years have gone by. And guess what? The problem hasn't been solved. I believe the political class call that pushback. I call that cave-in. So that's the influence at our military academies that my brethren from the Southern Baptist religion and likewise thinking people have, that they can actually take something which is flat against their oath of office. Because you do remember that constitution that we all took to defend and protect does call for this funny thing called separation of church and state. Odd how that works. So anyway, I decided I wasn't going to write another letter to this poor guy, because after 3 years, he's probably found something else to do, like retire. But in any case, the book that my friend and co-author Stephen Fortney and I have written doesn't have the same message as Mr. Hedges' book. There are a great number of similarities. The job that Stephen and I gave ourselves was basically two parts. First, are science and religion compatible? Because as you know, most people say that it's like football. You have the good, the Green Bay Packers, the bad, the Chicago Bears, and the ugly, the Dallas Cowboys. I'm quoting a recent sweater that I saw one of my friends wearing. Anyway, we didn't see it that way, and we don't see it that way. And the book that we've written provides arguments that say that there are, in fact, two types of truth-seeking, at least, but two main types. One is we call science, one we call religion, and they're compatible. They're complementary. That's a little different from some of the books that you may have heard, especially by the people who like this team sport analogy stuff. The other part is, in fact, the subtitle of our book, Living with Doubt. Now that's the part where we came very close to what Mr. Hedges has been talking about. Because if you do not doubt, how can you be sure of your faith? Because if you're simply accepting, it's not faith, it's indoctrination. By any name, it's still indoctrination. And so in the 12 chapters of our book, and just between us and the FBI's bug in the wall, that would be for the 12 Christian apostles, of course, can't resist. We ask questions like doubt and wasteland and individual journey and freedom, and we try to reconcile science and religion, or at least confuse the issue enough that you think we have. But with all my southern sort of humor aside, there is one thing that we do talk about that bears very closely on what Mr. Hedges has just discussed. And that can be summed up in one word. The word is gumption. In the last chapter of our book, which we entitle Hope, we ask the question, is there hope? And we say, yes, maybe. Good Midwesterners, you don't want to be definite. Anyway, we do, however, say that, just as Mr. Hedges has said, that the research universities and the scientists who do the work they do, they need to stop ignoring. So do we all, in fact. And for that, you need gumption. Because remember, we don't have to do what Dieter Bonhoeffer did. Dieter Bonhoeffer, for those of you who don't know, was a minister. He left Germany when the Nazis took over, shortly after. And he came back to Nazi Germany to fight against the Nazis and died in the death camps for his trouble. No, we don't have to do that. But we do have to have enough courage to speak out against the people who would basically turn freedom into irrationality, into a wasteland, indeed, as we talk about in our book. And I don't have a whole lot more to add, and I will certainly spare you any more southern humor. So thank you for your time.
Before I open up the floor for questions for either of our speakers, I'm wondering if Chris or Marshall, if you would like to have any conversation among yourselves. Are there things that you'd like further elaboration on?
I think we can open it up.
Yeah, I think opening it up would make sense, given the time and all.
Well, then the floor is open. Yes, sir, please stand and speak loudly so the whole assembly can hear.
Early on, you spoke of are being saved by faith. I'm wondering, what do you mean by saved?
Do you hear the question?
You need to turn it on.
Oh.
Can you hear the question? He asked early on, I spoke of being saved by faith. What did I mean by that? I think anyone who makes a realistic appraisal of our situation in the world right now has to admit that it's very bleak. The destruction of the ecosystem, the massive overpopulation of the planet, the wars that have already begun to be fought over dwindling natural resources, means that we're headed for a period of difficulty and probably immense human tragedy. And I think that many of us look around at the deterioration that is going on not only within the country but around us and feel overwhelmed and unable to do anything. And I think that that is where faith comes in. You know, it was, I covered for two decades some of the worst conflicts around the globe, including the wars in Central America, the Balkans. And the Serbs, or the Salvadorans, would go into a village, massacre a dozen, two dozen people, often women and children, and then cut the roads so that it couldn't be reported. There was no access. Our job as war correspondents and photographers was to walk in at some danger, record the atrocities that had been taken place, and to publish those that information in the paper, get it onto a television screen. Now, that didn't mean that we wouldn't wake up the next day and find the same thing had happened. And I think that when you're overwhelmed by that kind of violence and cruelty, it becomes very dangerous to say, well, nothing will change and it doesn't matter, and to adopt a kind of cynicism. I think that real spirituality for me is, and Bonhoeffer writes about this, is not this sort of narcissistic navel-gazing of, you know, how is it with me? But real spirituality is the spirituality of resistance. It is standing up and affirming something, even in the face of an absurdity, that is worth affirming. And I think in that sense, one is saved by faith, not a belief that we're God. Maybe by the end of our life, everything we fought for, stood for, and cared for has deteriorated and the situation is worse. But to have a belief that it's worth fighting for, even in the face of empirical evidence that it's hopeless and that it's getting worse. And I think that's where faith comes in, and that's where faith saves you.
Marshall would also like to reply.
I certainly agree with the faith part, but I also, since my education and my training and experiences in physics and the sciences, I believe that we can solve problems. So another part of this passivity idea, which I reject out of hand, is in essence, I cannot take care of myself, I have to have somebody take care of me for me. I don't buy that for a minute. And I simply don't buy the idea that we as a society, as a community, lack the knowledge and the willingness to solve problems in ways that at least make things better if they're not panaceas. So I think that one other part is to solve problems, and I think that can be done.
Yes, please.
Mr. Hedges, I agree a lot with you, and I got a lot out of your book on this subject. I agree mostly. But I'm trying to get a little perspective on this. Before I came over tonight, I read the article from the New York Times Sunday magazine a week ago Sunday called The Evangelical Crackup by David Kirkpatrick. Long article talking about the decline of the interest and activism around political themes in the evangelical community, as well as a rise, particularly in the under 30s, of a new form of the social gospel, kind of a conservative social gospel movement. And as a pastor, I serve many conservative churches in Wisconsin, though I never served up in central Wisconsin where the Posse Comitatus reigns. And I heard about churches or individuals who were dominionist types, but I never ran across many. I'm a Methodist, so I'm a mainliner. These were conservative churches. I found mainly people seeking comfort and indifferent to most of these things. On the other hand, you mentioned the CEO of Blackwater, and in some commentary on the news, he was identified as a Christian dominionist, and how that was the central ideology of his operation. And a couple of weeks ago, I listened to Mike Huckabee's speech to the Christian right as they were trying to fight a candidate. And behind his comfortable Baptist preacher, Southern humor type of approach, I heard a
better than mine.
I heard a lot of dominionist themes. So I'm trying to get a sociological perspective on the proportion of
that's a really
in relation to the total.
It's a really important point, and it is something that I do address at the beginning of the book, where I talk about, you know, the hardcore dominionist in terms of percentages within the evangelical fundamentalist community in the United States is probably 7% or less. It's small. But when you go back and study revolutionary movements, they're always highly skilled, highly disciplined, highly funded, and very and represent a tiny minority. One thinks, for instance, of the Bolsheviks, 1% of the Russian population at most. But what they can do, they speak in a language which is comforting and reassuring to a huge segment of the population. You as a minister know very well the way they have distorted all sorts of traditional Christian themes of concepts. I mean, I list, you know, I go into some detail in the book, but I mean, just for instance, the notion of liberty. They use the word liberty. Bush uses it all the time. He has an evangelical speechwriter, inserts it for him into his text. And liberty is a word that all of us in this room probably have a kind of common consensus in understanding what it is and what it's about. If you come out of this segment of the religious population, the only real liberty, true liberty, is submission to Jesus Christ, and complete submission to Jesus. And, of course, that means submission to those who purport to speak for Jesus Christ. All other liberty is false liberty. Anyone ever read Klemperer's book, I Shall Bear Witness? It's a fascinating book because it's the first literary critique of National Socialism. Klemperer was a professor, Jewish, Leipzig, lost his university post early on, and set about deconstructing Nazi language. Primarily. And I think you have to deconstruct the language of this movement because they use words that are reassuring to most of us and to certainly those people within the movement, but they've been hollowed out to mean something different. So while the percentage of hardcore dominionists is tiny, they can count on the sympathy of tens of millions of Americans. Because they're speaking in a language which is reassuring to them. Although, of course, many of these words are, it's a kind of newspeak quality, and that they're are almost diametrically opposed in meaning as to what is accepted conventionally. There's a powerful book by a historian called Claudia Kunz called The Nazi Conscience, in which she looks at the first years of the Nazi regime. And she talks about how the ascendancy of the Nazi Party was built because they were essentially going to restore moral values. It was about moral purity. And that Hitler apparently, between 1933 when he took power and 1938, only mentioned the Jews three times because the raw anti-Semitism just didn't go down among the larger German public. And many of the fringe elements within the Nazi Party accused Hitler of betraying them. And of being cowed by the internationally organized Jewish boycott of German goods, and I think that the Christian right is doing a very similar thing. So it is a tiny percentage, but that doesn't mean that it's not exceedingly dangerous.
Let me tell you a story. Stephen Fortney and I had a book signing in McFarland about 3 weeks ago. There was a pastor from Stoughton who shall, for reasons of libel, remain nameless. We can talk privately. And he was apparently very impressed with me, not with my co-author, but with me, the non-religious part of the team, as it were. So he sent me a DVD, which I still have, and he asked me, would I look at it and give him some feedback? And it was a DVD which he made with a man who runs a creation science group in Milwaukee, in Waukesha, and which was an hour-long conversation about two main topics, those being evolution and cosmology. evolution I know something about because we included it in our book, and so I learned. Cosmology I know something about because it's part of physics. So I gave him some feedback, and it ran to 4.5 typewritten single space pages and 18 items. And those were the ones that came to mind. Those statements included outright lies, half-truths, character assassination of people who didn't see things the way the guests did. Sounds like the Dominionist to me in terms of tactics. They're tactics that anyone who gets into politics, for example, knows all about, or they get out of politics. But the fact is, that's what's going on. So a person who doesn't know any better, a 10-year-old grandkid, goes to a church, gets this in their Bible study class. This is what you're going to read here today, an hour-long DVD, like a movie. And they would. Obviously, the 10-year-old won't know about evolution, won't know about cosmology, won't know about modern physics or biology. Why wouldn't that 10-year-old accept what these authority figures are telling him or her is in fact the case?
You have a $25 million creation museum in Peterborough, Kentucky, which I visited. You go in and see a recreation of the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve naked but discreetly positioned in a waterfall so you can't see her breasts or anything. With dinosaurs with saddles on them, because of course the dinosaurs were created at the same time as everyone and all the other, but they wouldn't harm people because it was peaceable. But then the thorny question of T-Rex's teeth came up, and the guide explained to us that T-Rex had such big teeth to crack open the coconuts for Adam and Eve. And then we went on and saw a recreation of Noah's Ark. And of course, the natural question is, how did Noah get the dinosaurs on the Ark? And Noah got the dinosaurs on the Ark because he only put baby dinosaurs on the Ark. You walk out of there and it's... you don't know whether to laugh or cry. I mean, the functional absurdity of it. I went to a creationist seminar in Missouri where they were giving lessons on Christian school teachers how to teach creation. And how do you deal with the fact that God created light on the first day and the sun on the fourth day? And the instructor said, well, you tell the children that God created a temporary light for 4 days. Well, there's nothing in Genesis that indicates that God created a temporary light. And it's in those kinds of details that you realize how irrational and frightening this belief system is, and how, as I said earlier in quoting Hannah Arendt, these people have been removed from a reality-based world. And unless you pull them back into a reality-based world, you're not going to argue them out of their belief, because the foundational aspects of their belief are not based on truth or logic. They're based on a need for emotional and psychological certitude.
Another woman over here.
I wanted to ask about unlimited tolerance and how that leads to intolerance. And I was thinking about how it seems like I see a lot of learned powerlessness on the part of so many of us who are not on Christian right, who have kind of learned that we can't do a thing about it. You know what I mean? We can't, corporations have taken over and we can't do a thing, as if we've all been separated. And what needs to happen for us to reclaim our power in a nice way?
Well, that's a really important question, because I think the corporation, citizens have one institution in a democratic state that represents their interest, and that is the government, however ineffectual and incompetent it can be. The government has been seized by the corporations, I mean, there was a front page story on today's New York Times about how the head of the regulatory agency that oversees the safety of products doesn't want an increase in the budget. You know, and this started, you know, with Reagan, but what was furthered by the Clinton administration, every single governmental department is run by corporations. You know, even under the Clinton administration, the Department of Labor was not handed over to, in a Democratic administration, to a representative of the labor community. So I voted for Ralph Nader. I'm not going to support. I believe that the corporate state is ultimately the issue. You know, we used to, if we all, are, those of us who are old enough to remember, think back 20, 30 years, people like Proxmire and others, they used to question absurd expenditures for weapons systems and $27 billion Trident submarines and waste and fraud, and nobody questions anything anymore. If we don't break the back of the corporate state, we're doomed, because what they have done, or and what they're doing, is essentially creating an oligarchic state, a kind of global serfdom, where you have a managerial elite, and roughly two-thirds of the country live in are impoverished. So I would say stepping outside of the two-party system is good. You're very right to point out that we're isolated. I mean, we live in a society that has become so fragmented and so alienated that the only communication we often have with the other is virtual, which isn't really communication. You know, I think that that destruction of community and that sense of isolation, which I think all of us feel, has been a powerful tool in the hands of those who seek to disempower us. I also, you know, and I was talking with Marshall about this, I think that I'm a writer, and I write regularly, and if anyone reads Common Dreams and Truth Out and Alternate, you know, this stuff, they'll see my stuff for The Nation. I just wrote a piece for The Nation, I think it's coming out next week, that if we go to war with Iran, I will stop paying my income taxes. I think that we have to, you know, it may be futile, but I think we have to begin to make personal decisions about what we're going to do. And I'm not saying everyone shouldn't pay their income tax. Everyone has to make that decision for themselves, what it is. But we have to begin to be proactive instead of standing around saying, why aren't there crowds of people on the street? Why don't people demonstrate? We have to stop asking those questions, and I think we have to turn inward, and we have to say, what am I going to do, even if it's futile, even if it doesn't change anything, what am I going to do to try and stick a spoke in the wheel? What kind of sacrifices am I going to make to try and halt this frightening slide towards a police state? And that's really what we're sliding towards.
Well, I don't have a whole lot to add. The things that occur to me are basically to realize that the institutions that individuals can control are primarily through their members of, in this case, congressional representative and U.S. senators. Well, even though I'm a political conservative, I kind of admire Russell Feingold because he is willing to do things. So speaking hypothetically, I would imagine if 5,000 people went into Ms. Baldwin and said, we're going to each spend $1,000 to unelect you if you don't initiate impeachment proceedings in the House of Representatives, which is where such proceedings are initiated, $5 million makes a hell of a war chest for somebody. And that's just a hypothetical. That's an example to me where people could sacrifice but not financially ruin themselves. and do something. But I think the problem is to realize what people were dealing with. One of the last people who worked with Senator Barry Goldwater before he died quite frequently has quoted Goldwater as saying, regarding the Christian concert right, I can't deal with these people. They don't compromise. We have to do everything they want or we're going to hell. And of course, Goldwater was not known for being calm and dispassionate in his expression. And those are the people that are being dealt with here. That's just the way it is.
Somebody from the back. From the back, please. Yes.
Mr. Hedges, I've got a few municipal questions who will probably be considered unionized.
Can you speak louder, please?
Okay. I've had some business partners who would be considered dominionists. And so I understand how skewed the mindset is. But my question is, part of your thesis is that the base for that movement is formed from the essentially despair of working class. And given that the leaders of that movement are very affluent by and large, I mean, none of them have taken also poverty. My question is, at what point, the political agenda of the movement is almost a classist agenda, and it does not support the working class by and large, it supports the very affluent. And at what point does the self-interest of the individual bump up against the agenda of the movement?
That's a really good question. Did everyone hear that?
No.
And he's saying that the leaders of this movement are personally wealthy, and they don't represent the interests of the working class. And at what point is there a clash between the leaders and the working class? I would argue there isn't one. The reason is this. The Democratic Party betrayed the working class in this country, especially under the administration of Bill Clinton. That's what NAFTA did. That's what welfare reform did. And Thomas Franks wrote that book, What's the Matter of Canvas, which is a great book and worth reading. But he asked the question, how can these people vote against their interests? Well, they're not voting against their interests. The rage towards liberals on the part of the working class is not misplaced. It's a rational response to betrayal. The Democratic Party, until the Clinton administration, looked out for the interests of its members, which were rank and file working class people, many of them from my own family. And Clinton understood that the corporations were quite willing to fund the Democratic Party. We have a memo from Clinton in the late 1980s explaining this to the Democratic leadership, that the working class was going to vote for the Democratic Party anyway. And by the 1990s, the Democrats had reached fundraising parity with the Republicans. And we see in the current campaign, in fact, the Democrats are getting more money than the Republicans. And so the working class has nowhere to go because both political parties have sold them out. And all they have left is to become embraced in this movement. Now, what does this movement, this non-reality-based belief movement, tell them? It tells them that if you have enough faith and you believe in Jesus, he'll take care of you financially. Watch Pat Robertson. You know, I was, you know, drinking too much, and then I found Jesus, and now look at my Cadillac. I mean, it's that crude. That Jesus will heal you. You don't need health insurance, because if you're right with Jesus, you know, and Pat will sit there on the screen and put his hands to his temple and go, I see a woman in a red sweater and she has back pains and the Holy Spirit, you know. And so it is really a very cruel manipulation and abuse of tremendous personal despair. I don't think we will break the back of this movement until we re-enfranchise these people back into the American system. I think that, you know, that's why you have large corporations like Walmart, Sam's Club, others, that are putting these Dominionist chaplains in their warehouses and factories to to proselytize to their workers. Because, you know, it is, you know, steal a line from Marx, this kind of religion is an opiate. It allows people to essentially advocate in a kind of cruel twist of fate for their own enslavement.
Yes, sir.
I just got two real quick questions. I'm about the least religious guy you could meet, but I always hear people saying the Bible is meant to be taken, much of it, as parables, you know, just transcendental thinking. How do we know what these people meant when they wrote it? How do we know that it was or wasn't supposed to be taken literally? How do we know that? And number two, isn't much of this religious fundamentalism a reaction to discussions that people just weren't having 30, 40 years ago, like the issues of homosexuality? I graduated high school in 1990, and it wasn't even really a topic that even came up. You know, you never even heard about it amongst youth. I mean, these seem to be kind of new discussions where 30, 40 years ago, you didn't even have the people who had conservative values didn't feel the need to bring it up. I mean, it was a no-brainer, you know, that this wasn't even discussed.
Well, he's asking, how do you know the intent of the writers of the Bible? There were so many writers in the Bible. Many of them had, you know, the intents were very different. Even within the four Gospels, the intents were different. And you have to place, you know, the Hebrew Bible was written over a span of several hundred years. Many of those passages were responding to specific historical events. For instance, the book of Revelation was responding to the despotism of Nero. And the call for, you know, when these sort of bloody passages are talking about the, you know, that apocalyptic moment when Christians rise up and defeat the Roman Empire. I mean, so there is no uniform vision in the part of the Bible because, first of all, it was never a book. It was, you know, the word is ta biblia. It means little books. And it was only made into a book in the 3rd century. If you wanted to read the Bible, you went into a bookseller's shop and there were little wooden boxes with a series of scrolls. Some of them had wisdom literature, some of them had, you know, history, some of them had psalms, some of them had aphorisms, you know, and there was no order. I mean, the order was imposed later. So the Bible, when it was written, was never meant to be coherent. I mean, look at the book of Ecclesiastes, which is beautiful. I mean, it could have been written by Samuel Beckett. It's about a morally neutral universe. It's about despair. It's about how everything is vanity. It's about, you know, so you find, you know, widely divergent views in the Bible when you read it carefully. There is no uniform. I mean, of course, the Christian fundamentalists will claim that there is, but there isn't. And they only can claim that by ignoring huge sections of the Bible. And one of the most interesting things about interviewing all these people is how biblically ignorant they are. When you really get, I mean, you know, having been raised in the church and graduated from seminary, they don't actually know the Bible very well. They have the Bible, bits and pieces of the Bible fed to them, but they don't actually know the Bible. And your other question about...
a reaction to discussions we just weren't having 30, 40 years ago.
A reaction to, well, I think Karen Armstrong makes a very important point that the fundamentalist movements, and she writes about, she's a really great writer. I just, you know, I admire all of her work. But she writes in The Battle for God, which is on Jewish, Christian, Islamic, and Hindu fundamentalism, that these are not traditional movements, they're distinctly modern movements. And I think she's right, not only in the way that they harness mass communications, but in the way that they seek to legitimize themselves, not through their religious texts, as they claim, but through pseudoscience. You know, that's why you have creationism. That's what creationism is. It's like eugenics. It's a pseudoscience meant to legitimize the creation myth in Genesis. Because they know that their followers are not going to be convinced unless they can marshal scientific jargon and distort scientific facts to justify the creation myth. So I think that when you start breaking down these movements, although they talk about traditional values, and although they talk about, you know, reaching back to a lost, you know, mythical period of American history in a Christian nation, they are distinctly modern in their outlook, and part of that, of course, is their obsession with violence, with violence as a cleansing agent, kind of purging agent to purify the world and essentially destroy the world that they hate. I mean, this is really a movement about death.
It's a movement about hatred. This world around them, they believe, tried to destroy them. And the greatest endpoint of human history, the greatest and most glorious moment, in their eyes, is the physical destruction of the planet and everybody on the planet who does not submit to their authority. That's what they celebrate constantly.
We've already gone beyond time, and I'm wondering if there would be a question that deals with science in particular. If not, we'll take one last question. Is there a science question?
Prohibits religious tests, and in that one Democratic debate, they asked all the candidates if they believed in evolution. I think it'd be nice to have a scientific test for holding office.
Can you repeat the question, please?
It was a comment that said we're not allowed to ask candidates, or candidates don't have to have a religious litmus test, but perhaps we should ask political candidates whether or not they should pass a science test, such as, do you believe in evolution? So I will take the question in the back, because you were standing and waving your arm since the beginning, so please.
Can you consider economics a science? A question about Paul Krugman's book, The Great Unraveling, where in the preface he cites Henry Kissinger's thesis, dissertation, I guess, that talks about a period in Germany after the Napoleonic Wars, where a revolutionary movement took over, and how the virus keeps yielding to the revolutionaries. And it's very much like the period today. And I wonder if you discussed this with Paul Krugman, as your ideas and his in that regard.
I had dinner with Krugman about a year ago. And I think on this issue we're completely in sync, that if you look back on the last few decades, for those of us who care about an open, tolerant, pluralistic, democratic society, we have just taken one step backwards after another. And I think Ralph Nader asked the right question. At what point do you stand up and say, I'm tired of voting for the least worst? Because it's not a deal you're going to win. The game of politics is about power. It's not about morality. And the only thing people in power understand is power. And the only power we have is to walk away from them. Until we are willing to do that, we're not going to bring pressure on them to change. I mean, the 2000 campaign by Nader freaked the Democrats out. You know, Nader wanted to hold a rally in Madison Square Garden. He didn't have any money. So he rented the garden and took a gamble. And he charged everyone who came to the rally $5 at the door, and he paid for the garden. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, to self-selected candidates in the Democratic Party, you can imagine how they responded to this. And they started in 2000 and worked to destroy Nader. And they have destroyed Nader. And it's the Democrats, and largely the Clintons, who destroyed Nader. Because there was a groundswell. Not 2004, but in 2000. And that frightened them. And until that groundswell comes back, we're going to be sheared like sheep. There's a wonderful line by the great rabbi Abraham Heschel, who got in trouble with his colleagues at Jewish Theological Seminary when he walked with Martin Luther King on the Sabbath. And they condemned him. And he told them, I pray with my feet. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and I hope to see you here next week.